We hope you enjoy the following presentation of Collective Myths and Individual Development by Leila Rayal. This is the second of four audios of a talk given on the morning of Sunday, September 25, 1983, at the RITA Conference in Palo Alto, California. This recording is 31 minutes long. This audio is brought to you by RITA, the Rudyard Institute for Transpersonal Activity, a nonprofit public benefit corporation dedicated to disseminating the work and essential message of Dane Rudyard. All material is copyrighted by Leila Rudyard Hill. If you'd like to learn more about RITA or make a donation towards supporting the ongoing legacy of Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Rudyard, visit www.rudyardaudioarchives.com. And now, Leila Rayal.
Sometimes we tend to think that the job of the I is to operate as benign or not so benign dictator and whip all these things in shape, right? Whip our personalities in shape and deal with this complex over here and either get rid of it or reintegrate it and you move over there and you stop doing this. But according to what ideal? Who tells the I what to do? Have you noticed that there are fashions in healthy people? There are cultural fashions in what constitutes psychological well-being and social success. And they change. Sometimes they change from decade to decade, and sometimes things are a little bit more long-lasting. Maybe it's a little bit longer cycle, a longer wavelength than hemlines. But it's a very similar kind of process. The main thing to understand, and this is something that metaphysically and philosophically Rudyard stresses, is again always the idea of context is within the person individualizing. Many of these complexes, many of these things that we would wish to put under the control of the I, and then the I taking its orders from the collective psychism, then everything would stay nicely at that level, we'd all fit into the society and we'd all live happily ever after. Fine. One problem. The society is not in its state of flowering. The society is in its autumnal phase. It's letting go of its seed pods. And the seeds are individuals. Rudyard has talked about it in the sense that biology is the root. Culture are the leaves. Culture is the leaves. Personhood is the flower. And individuality, the individuals, are the seed, and the transpersonal is the mutation that occurs in the seed that makes the next generation of a different level.
Could you repeat that one more time? Yeah.
Biology is the root. Mm-hmm. Culture is the leaves. Personhood, that sense of being I. Personhood and, as it were, the lower level of individuality, is the flower. Individuality consecrating itself to the whole is the seed. And the transpersonal is the mutation in the seed. Now again, just as this is a cyclic process, I as an aside, I've always found, for me, the metaphor of the cycle of annual vegetation is so rich, it's virtually inexhaustible in terms of understanding processes from its symbolism. And I encourage you all to play with it. But this is a process. Just as in life, Nikki was talking about yesterday the progressed lunation cycle. And when we think of those approximately three, the new moon before birth being one beginning one cycle, and then birth within that, in a sense representing the biological level, biological birth. The second, the first full progressed lunation cycle, essentially deals with this personhood, the development of personhood. Of course, depending on when you're born into the lunation, the ego begins to develop early, obviously. But then in the first progressed lunation, that is properly the time at which the, during which the relation between the individual and collective, the socio-cultural level, the development of the personality, the integration of the whole person, comes together. And then at some point during that, usually at the last quarter square, then the real shift and the beginning of the process of individualization, maybe. Now again, much of this interpenetrates, and we do often, especially today, aspects of the whole, not just the I, but aspects of the whole, as it were, are working toward individualization, while others are working toward integrating the person and the society. So the situation gets rather complex. But the main thing is to see this as an ongoing process, as a sort of yin-yang relationship between the individual and collective, one waxing as the other wanes, and feeding the other, each one feeding the other. Because there is that kind of return, the idea of a body, let's put it this way, a particular, a singularity, with the potential of individuality, being born in the generic collective, generic meaning the body, generically human, in the collective psychism, the mind being cultured by the collective psychism, the mind being cultured within the culture, then the process of individualization. Now, the process of individualization is essentially what produces dukkha, a Buddhist word for which it's usually translated as suffering, but I don't think suffering is really a good translation of it. Neither does Ridger. He tends to equate it with the German Angst, that sort of existential anguish of being separate in the world, which does involve suffering, but it's more pervasive than suffering. Of alienation. Now, the question came up Friday night also about, okay, what do you do in that situation of feeling alienated from your natal culture and yet feeling that need for connection to something else that is also collective? The individual cannot stand totally alone. The isolated, rugged individual, that's a myth in the other sense of the term. That's a myth in the no man is an island sense of the term. Trying to do that produces, in a sense, what occultists have talked about as the black path of just trying to stand against the flow of evolution, because the flow of evolution is always dealing with this interplay between individual and collective, the emergence of the individual out of the collective and then a return but to the collective. But at what level is the question that we're dealing with now? From Ridjar's point of view, that sense of isolation, that feeling of dukkha, can force one, as it were, to open oneself to the idea of a higher collectivity, not simply a cultural collectivity into which one was born, but a higher collectivity that is essentially constituted by all those formerly human beings who have passed through the eye of the needle, so to speak, of that process of individualization, and who have gone beyond the state of individual selfhood, who have really truly identified themselves with humanity as a whole, and who are there as elder brothers, masters, whatever, however we choose to designate them. But the higher collectivity that is, in a sense, the soul of the earth. Now, this obviously presents a very different picture from the myth of the relation between the individual and the collective that we're used to dealing with. We deal with it politically all the time in this era, so-called free world versus the communist world, where in the West we tend to stress the value and primacy of the individual, and in the communist world, they stress the primacy and absolute value of the collective, of the state. There are perhaps, and I don't want to get into a political discussion, but there are perhaps more similarities between the two than one would like to see in a lot of ways. And they're definitely poles of the same sort of thing. But this is operating essentially on an either-or level. And I think what is lacking and what needs to be seen from the spiritual perspective is the interrelationship between the two polarities in us. If you realize, if you criticize the society, if we criticize our culture, realize that that is in us. And that what I was talking about yesterday and what Rudyard has been stressing as the development of a new mind means freeing oneself from the assumptions, from those quality of pervasive assumptions that can make me see a rectangle when there's a trapezoid there. And the degree to which you can do this, the degree to which you can separate yourself from this, is obviously limited. When Rudyard was asked the question about that, he pointed out, I think what he was saying was, it was a very interesting way of putting it, and I was really quite impressed with his answer. The idea that while one can separate one's mind, one's consciousness, one's individual consciousness, and begin to function in relative freedom from those assumptions of one's society, that there always remains a connection. One has a karma, one is born into a particular society, one is part of it, one is an efflorescence of it. One cannot separate oneself from the collective. And from this point of view, to try to do that, to try to set oneself up in a way as a spiritual survivalist, you know, sitting up on a hill someplace on your 50-pound sack of rice with a gun, so that when the world is about to end and there's a nuclear war, you can survive, but they can't. That can't be done, is what he's saying. And at the same time, one can separate oneself somewhat, and yet there is always a connection. There is, as it were, an interplay between the two. Part of the interplay between the two brings up another myth that Rudyard has talked about, which is the myth of egalitarianism, the myth of equality, and the myth of democracy that we're very much ingrained within this society. Part of the relationship between the individual and collective and why one remains tied, as it were, is that basic principle, whenever one is given, there is a debt. Have you ever noticed that oftentimes when you need something in your own life and you have one of those magical experiences, you go to the right bookstore, somebody hands you something, someone says, oh, you should go see so-and-so, turns out to be the exactly right thing in your life. Shortly thereafter, someone else comes along that you have to pass it along to, who is either asking for the same thing or something that, in a sense, only you can give them. And always, whenever one is given, one owes, and one is asked, not so much to repay, but to pass it on, to keep the chain going, as it were. And if one is born in a particular culture and society, and one does manage, it develops one's mind in a particular way, and one does manage to separate oneself from that and begin to identify with a higher collectivity. As one's consciousness does that, the compassion and the openness and the need to put back, to plow back into the soil, as it were, of the culture is there. Now, how that occurs depends upon something that's extraordinarily important, which is the notion of function. You know, there's this saying that all men are created equal. I think they mean women, too, when they say that. All men are created equal, but some are more equal than others. It's not, and equal is really, it's a word that essentially equal is only used in terms of quantity. Two things are only equal in terms of their quantity. You can never equate quality. You can never equate talent. really. Because it's different. You can only equate quantity. You count it up. And it has nothing to do with quality, only numbers. And yet, human beings, we are not all equal. We have an equal number of hands, fingers, and toes, and all of that kind of thing. But we're all different. In terms of spiritual value, we are equal. I mean, we are all spiritually valuable. We are all human. We are all essentially human. And yet, we all have different temperaments, different experiences, different karmas, different dharmas, different possibilities for contributing to the social process, different possibilities for contributing to the evolutionary process, because we all meet different experiences within this common collective framework. Today, in our democratic, actually, it's democracy, it's really kind of government by adding machine. And I've often asked myself the question, why is it that 51 people are smarter than 49? Way to do it. Okay, but these are questions that one must ask oneself in order to free the mind from the domination by the collective. To ask egalitarianism, lack of a notion of function, lack of a sense of quality, only an emphasis on quantity, which, you know, you realize an emphasis on quantity derives essentially from an overemphasis on matter. You can count matter. It's infinitely divisible. You can keep chopping it up in little pieces. Quality, you can't deal with. Quality has to be dealt with on a judgmental basis. I don't mean judgmental in terms of negative. In terms of making a judgment, a feeling, differentiation, distinction between things. It's subjective. It cannot be. Quantity can be ascertained and agreed upon by all of us. Quality cannot. Okay. And yet, by the same token, Rajah is extraordinarily good in his civic duties. He votes, and he won't vote on something that he doesn't understand. And he always tries to understand the issue and try to understand at the level of the society, to accept it on its own level and to participate in the most constructive way he can, realizing that his dharma is not to be a politician. He realizes that's not his area. He's also very thankful. He oftentimes, whenever the presidential elections comes along, he always says that he can't imagine why anybody would want to do that. He's very, very thankful that that wasn't his dharma. But we have to question these kind of things to free ourselves, to free our minds from this collective domination. Because much of when we get into the root myths that are behind the society that we tend not to think about. I mean, we tend to deal with the surface of what comes up on the surface. It's like the waves on the surface that are created by these large undersea earthquake movements of plates kind of thing. We tend to focus on the surface, but we have to get to what is at the depths, really underneath, what are the moving forces, and then evaluate what happens at the surface in terms of that. Rudra has also said, in terms of these myths, when talking particularly about the myth of science and the myth of empirical knowledge, that oftentimes when we talk about myths, people will say, but science deals with facts, it doesn't deal with myths. And he says, this is a quotation from Rajar, only a naive and unhistorical mind can think that facts are more powerful than myths. Facts change, you know, from culture to culture and society to society and time to time. No, Richard? You're shaking your head?
Had a very interesting argument on that basis with William Hewlett about how facts change or don't change. And he pointed out the major one that we have all seen in the last, actually seen, possibly within our lifetimes, is the fact that time is not immutable. That was the major fact of life for a long time, was that time was constant and always time. Mm-hmm. With Einstein, we found out maybe time wasn't.
Maybe.
That's a great example.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And that's, but you see, the thing is that that's an important point, is that it's not only the fact, you see, the scientific fact of what time is, that's not important. What's important is the myth. Okay. Because now, the myth of relativity. And again, I don't mean it in the sense of it's an untruth. I don't know whether it's true or not. And no one else does. From Bujar's point of view, there can be, at least at our human level, there can be no absolute truth. Because there are many stations, many levels, many perspectives. And what is true from one level or one perspective is true to that perspective. And in Culture Crisis, he talks about the myth of reality. And he mentions the Plato with the people sitting in the cave, chained to the cave with their backs to the entrance and a fire throwing shadows against the wall. Okay. The shadows are real. They're real shadows. There's nothing unreal about a shadow. But it's a shadow. To someone who can see, it's a shadow. But to someone who can't see that it's a shadow, that's also real. They just don't make the distinction between shadow real and matter, solid real. So facts are, in a sense, what we make them. We, meaning a culture. And facts are basically, it comes from the word factum, which means to make. We make up the facts as we go along. No, we do. We do. We make them up and we agree upon them. And facts are what all supposedly sane people in a society make up, decide, or so.
So in a sense, it's a consensus reality that's built on the collective psyche.
Yes. 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 But realize, you see, now the thing is that, and this brings up a very important point, is that this consensus reality does not develop, you know, like the Democrats calling a caucus and we all get together and decide on a reality. It's, in a sense, the potentiality for it, at least some aspects of it, is there a priori to the people, to the act, because each generation is born into that developing reality. It's a growing matrix. It's kind of like the mystery of when you have a gestating body, each generation of cells is born into, coming out of, born into a new place in it. And according to the latest theories, it's a very interesting thing in embryology. Depending upon where the cell finds itself next to what other kind of cells, that's how it knows what to become. Mm-hmm. When and where it develops. Yes.
Are you here?
Am I here? What do you mean by that?
Yes or no?
That sounds like a trick question to me. Okay, I'll bite. Yes, I'm here.
Can we say collectively that it is a fact that you are here?
Yeah, you can say that.
So
what do you are? Pardon me?
And then can we believe that?
You can do whatever you want.
I'm suggesting that there are different types of facts that we as human beings can believe.
In our perception of the world. Okay. Now, for example, yeah. Okay. But supposing, you see, part of that then would hinge on. I'm trying in my mind to make up a way of. I'm playing the devil's advocate to your question, is to turn that around. And supposing that there were a superhuman being here, who would look at this body in the someone who has passed through the individual, the human stage, and has gone beyond this. Someone who would look at this lump of matter sitting in this chair, who would say, what do you mean by you? What do you mean by her? Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that...
What do you mean by here?
Yeah. There are some facts that are more basic than other facts. But then... That is all part of the mythos of the human reality. I mean, we use those kind of words like here and you and all of that, which are also conditioned by the senses.
You're just a collection of basic elements, whatever those are.
Well, yeah, see, but that's from the from the scientific point of view, from the reductionist point of view, the myth of science, you can say you are just a collection of basic elements, which is to reduce me back to molecules, or even lower than that, okay. But then that is to say that all I am. But then there's that mysterious thing, I. Yes.
Going back to when you were speaking about Plato's cave sophism, most people, it initially set out to me, is that it seemed that the point was that the shadows were mistakenly determined as being real, but the point is the shadows were real.
Yes, to the people. If that's all you can see is shadows, that's your reality.
And once somebody's accepted the shadows are real, they would tend to assume that they could make the next statement and say, well, then that's reality. By the time you've said that, reality's gone on and changed, and so the perception can't quite catch up to the whole.
Well, in that particular case, for example, if you say that, and nobody has gotten up and has looked outside and seen that they are reflections of some other bodies, then that would be, you would say that's reality, and that would be your reality. However, as soon as somebody gets up, and goes outside and sees that there's something else happening of which you are seeing a reflection or some other consequence, and comes back and convinces a few other people that that's so, that they should break their bonds and come out and see, then reality comes up for question. And there's one of those large shifts in what the reality is. Now, it's not unknown for human beings to go through those kinds of shifts of what is reality. It takes a long time, but if you think about the idea of living, say, in an animistic society, an animistic tribe, where everything is alive, rocks and trees and the forces of nature are all alive and are to you entities, very unpredictable entities, something we read about in books, but really think about what the experience of that is. That is a different reality.
Once the mind has tried to define reality, once you've said the beginning of your sentence, reality's gone on, but in the mind's trying to define reality, the mind tries to stop itself in time, and at the same time all the definitions being formulated, reality's going on and on, and by the time the sentence is out, history and reality's changed and gone on, so I don't think...
Yeah, what I'm saying is that there are sometimes, no, I think what you're saying is that now that is happening to a great extent. There are times in a culture's development when reality is relatively stable. This is not one of those times. And it's an important thing to realize. You see, for example, many people, just I'm talking about on a personal level, many people will say, come to an astrologer, what is my dharma? You know, what am I meant to do? But even the very fact of talking about these things, rather than not ever having any contact with them in life, that is an indication of one's dharma, that we are participating, we are that part of that aspect of humanity that is participating in this shift at this time. And that this essentially is not something that each of us individually chooses to do. It's not a personal thing. And the problems that develop in our lives as a result are not, I mean, they are personal, meaning we have to handle them personally. But they are not personal problems. They come as a result of the interface between our particular function, our particular dharma, and the collective situation in which we find ourselves. Yes, Ira?
Could you pursue the shadows into the myth of the black path? Sense of separation from, or severance from the collective psychism, wherein Rudyard has stated the need for self-protection as one rises to higher and higher levels of consciousness.
I'm not following you there, I'm sorry.
You commented earlier about the black path.
That was the idea of the process of individualization and individualism for its own sake. The ego, then the I center of the personality is really a better term there, becoming very strong to maintain itself against the collective. Okay. But the movement of evolution is toward collective again, but at a higher level, and yet standing against that. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Is that, that's what, and that is not alienation. Alienation, that's, well, I mean, playing with words, but that is usually not felt as a tragic kind of alienation and the need for reconnection. That is felt as the necessity to will oneself separate and to maintain that, which, to will oneself separate and to be able to maintain that at one point in the process is essential. But then at another point, to will to maintain that beyond the time when its function has been served, when it then becomes time to take the next step, which is to identify with a higher collectivity, then that's anti-evolutionary, which is essentially evil. The way Ridgar has defined evil in that sense is anything that stands against the direction of evolution that is needed at that time in the process.
How does Ridgar protect himself against that evil?
What do you mean, protect himself?
A sense of self-protection.
From what?
That evil, that black path, that state.
You mean the desire for that individuality for its own sake?
No, in terms of collective forces, which are polarized just like natural forces.
You'll have to ask Ridgar then.
Okay.
Now, I mean, I think, you know, in terms of internally, that's why I mentioned yesterday, in terms of spiritual development, why there's an important balance needed between courage and will and humility.
This is the end of part two of Collective Myths and Individual Development by Leila Rial from the 1983 RITA conference. The preceding audio is copyrighted by Leila Ruggiar Hill and was brought to you by RITA, the Ruggiar Institute for Transpersonal Activity. Learn more about RITA or contribute to the ongoing legacy of Dane Ruggiar at www.ruggiarinstitute.org. For the complete selection of free downloads of audio presentations by Dane Ruggiar, visit www.ruggiaraudioarchives.com.